The following lecture by Dr. Gordon H. Clark is entitled Veridicalism.
Before I came up here, I had some correspondence with Dean, what's his name? Roberts. And he had previously written me concerning the contents of the course, and I answered somewhat at length. And among other things, I said to him that if he knew who would be taking the course, they might read Crucial Questions in Apologetics by Mark Hanna, is that right? And try to figure out how I would answer him. I don't know how many of you did that. Some of you did. Well, apparently some of you did. I didn't know whether he could get to you in time or not. So I'm going to read my paper on Mark Hanna. And I think there will be enough explanation in this lecture so that even if you have not read his book, you will understand the argument. Though, of course, those who have read the book will understand it better. The more material you read, the more you study, well, the better you get. So this is on the Crucial Questions in Apologetics. Professor Hanna's ambitious aim is to construct an apologetic method named veridicalism. That's a name he coined. A method named veridicalism to avoid the stalemate between presuppositionism. Now, he doesn't use the word presuppositionalism, which is ordinarily used frequently. I guess it's the most right. He thinks that's a little too long a word, so he changes it to presuppositionism. And when I'm quoting him, I will quote him as he writes. If I give some of my own ideas, I may use the term I'm accustomed to. Well, he aims to construct an apologetic method named veridicalism to avoid, quote, the stalemate between presuppositionism and verificationism. Or one might say, between fideism and empiricism. Or again, between a priorism and the tabula rasa theory. Of course, these terms need some definition. Yet the first three quarters of the book is sparse in definition. One must read almost 100 pages before finding out what some important terminology means, and then go back and read the whole thing again. There are two definitions given near the beginning, but sometimes a later definition is substantially different from an earlier one. One of these terms thus ambiguous is fideism or presuppositionism. These two words always seem to be synonymous, and if you've read the book, you'll have to decide whether you think they are or not, but they seem to me to be synonymous. And since the author aims to present a theory that is neither fideistic nor verificationistic, neither Calvinistic nor Arminian, the fideism should be restricted to a single, well-defined meaning throughout the book. But this is not the case. Preparing for a definition, the author begins by asserting that fideism destroys the possibility of truth and knowledge, page 17, so that, quote, every view, irrespective of its absurdities, is on the same epistemological footing with every other view. I did have a pen in my hand a few times when I was reading your papers, and when somebody misspelled epistemological, I put a little red circle, at least in some cases. Maybe I missed a few. Please try to spell epistemological. And I must say, however, that the spelling of these papers in this class is considerably better than the students. Well, he doesn't restrict the term fideism to one single meaning. Preparing for a definition, the author begins by asserting that fideism destroys the possibility of truth and knowledge, so that, quote, every view, irrespective of its absurdities, is on the same epistemological footing as other view. End of quote. On the same, quote, can one be a theist and avoid such sequence, namely absurdity? End of quote. Properly speaking, this is a description. In actuality, it is a conclusion after valid arguments have been given to support it. Yet it reveals some important characteristics which the author thinks he sees in the nature of fideism. But if so, one must ask. Now remember how he described, not defined, but described fideism. It's something that destroys the possibility of truth and knowledge. If so, one must ask, are there any fideists loose in the neighborhood? Does anyone claim to hold a view that his description fits? In what books may we find his description accepted and defended? Maybe there are such people, but who are they, and what reasons do they offer in favor of this position? Barth and Bruner may be two satisfactory examples of his notion of fideism. But are these two theologians presuppositionalists? Or to make the question clearer, are there two sorts of fideism? One which fits Hannah's description and claims that no theory is better than any other, and a second type of fideism that denies an equal epistemological basis to absurdities. Can there not be a presupposition that insists on the difference between truth and falsity? I could mention two names in support of this contention. Now, the author has several good pages defending fixed truth and the necessity of logic. Indeed, these are very good pages. But his refutation of fideism, as stated and as applicable to Barth and Bruner, has incautiously and without further argument been extended to include presuppositionalists who abhor absurdities as much as the author does. There is a second case of faulty definition. I want to give maybe three, I guess I give another, three indications that he doesn't very well define his terms, and a reader has a good deal of difficulty knowing what he's talking about. There is a second case of faulty definition. The fault, however, differs from the preceding. In the previous case, a definition correctly applied to one position was transferred to a view which, at least prima facie, contradicts it. Here in this case, this second case, two definitions merge in such a way that neither serves any necessary function. The terms defined are certainty and certitude. And now I'm going to read two or three pages, which may seem tedious to you, about certainty and certitude. If you are very ambitious, you may be able to keep awake. But if you didn't go to bed till 1 p.m. last night and you got up at 4 this morning, here is your chance to take a nap. The words are certainty and certitude. Beg pardon? Well, it begins with page 58, but it goes for, 40 or 50 pages, I think. But you can start on page... I'll give another page later on. It's page 81. Maybe I have some other pages. 58 as the of an objective state of affairs. Do you find those words on that page?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I must have quoted them correctly for a change. And try to keep that in mind. This may not be a definition, but at any rate, he gives it as one necessary element in the definition. And it is the intellectual apprehension of an objective state of affairs. One's first impression of this phrase, and now I might say this was my first impression. Of course, it doesn't follow that everybody else has the same first impression I do, but anyhow, it is a possible impression. One's first impression of this phrase, especially as it is said to differ from certitude, which is, quote, a subjective assurance. Now, he's going to define certitude, or at least characterize it, as a subjective assurance. And one's first impression is that certainty attaches to propositions, an intellectual apprehension of a state of affairs. That's the word certainty attaches to propositions, and certitude attaches to minds only. We could call the latter subjective and the former objective. Clearly, on this understanding of the definition, certitude is possible when the position is false. Many people are assured of what is untrue. In fact, the author on page 81 acknowledges that on one level there are experiences of misplaced certitude. But, quote, but any case of conviction whose reference state of affairs is as someone holds it is to be an example of certainty. I'll read that sentence again. I got one word wrong. But any case of conviction whose reference state of affairs is as one holds it to be is an example of certainty. Now, I say this is a first impression. Maybe we will change our idea of what he means later on. But the first time you read it, the first time I read it at any rate, it seems that certainty is something objective and certitude is something subjective. And on page 81, he acknowledges that on one level, whatever that may mean, that's the trouble, he didn't tell you what that meant. He acknowledges that on one level there are experiences of misplaced certitude. Quote, but any case of conviction whose reference state of affairs is as someone holds it to be is an example of certainty. His next sentence, however, on page 81, his next sentence, unfortunately, is disconcerting. On another level, however, we may call into question the certainty we acknowledge on the first level. Oh, I thought certainty attached to propositions. Now it doesn't seem to. We had a proposition that was certain on one level, objectively true, and on another level, this that was objectively true before is now false. His next sentence, unfortunately, is disconcerting. On another level, however, we may call into question the certainty we acknowledge on the first level, end of quote. Now, aside from the fact that these levels remain unspecified, and we haven't the least idea what he means, but in addition to that, aside from that, one must ask, should not the sentence that I just quoted have said certitude rather than certainty? If certainty is a quality of a true proposition, we cannot deny or even doubt that a true proposition is certain. That's just tautologous. We may doubt that a proposition we have in mind is true, but this is misplaced certitude, not misplaced certainty. Furthermore, if certainty is objective and attaches to propositions, then certainty does not require certitude. There are many propositions which are certain, of which a man, either ignorant or confused by them, can have no certitude. Suppose I should tell you that there are as many prime numbers as there are numbers. Well, you may have a hard time determining whether that is certain or not. And as you were trying to figure it out, you wouldn't have any certitude. And you might work a long while before you figured out what was meant. If certainty is objective and attaches to propositions, then certainty does not require certitude. There are many propositions which are certain, of which a man, either ignorant or confused by them, can have no certitude. But if this be the author's meaning, then certainty, attaching to propositions, means no more than the propositions are true. And if this be so, the term certainty is superfluous and confusing. Certitude would be the only meaningful term. However, our first interpretation of the defining clause may have been mistaken. Maybe certainty is not altogether objective. Maybe it attaches to mind as certitude does. The defining clause says that certainty resides in the intellectual apprehension. Such a certainty would be as subjective as certitude. But the author straddles the issue. He wants certainty to be a quality of both the mind and the proposition. On page 85, you can turn over to that if you can find it. On page 85, he states that, quote, certainty requires both subjective assurance and the truth or reality of that which is apprehended. So apparently, certainty is at least partly subjective and isn't altogether objective. Certainty requires both subjective assurance. Now, that's subjective, isn't it? It also requires the truth or reality of that which is apprehended, such as there are as many prime numbers as there are numbers. Just how one quality, certainty, can attach univocally to the mind, the intellectual apprehension, and to an external state of affairs is hard to understand, and he doesn't explain it. Bypassing this embarrassing difficulty, The following diagram seems to picture Hannah's definitions. draw this sort of on the board. Suppose this circle represents all propositions, and these propositions are false, and these are true. Now then, we have an inner circle, something like this, and we will find that certitude is the whole circle, but of course, these propositions which we have subjective assurance of are false because they're in this half, and over here, these are true. I look at that a minute while I... The inclusive circle, the big circle on the board, has as its objects all propositions. Half of them true and half false. The middle circle takes in all propositions that one has in mind. This middle circle. The rest you don't know, whether true or false. You don't know all the propositions there. The middle circle takes in all the propositions that you are thinking of. And also, that you believe. Now, the right-hand half of it, you're assured of all of them. This is the circle of certitude. But the proposition on the right-hand side here, I drew it differently here, and this is the left. The proposition on this side, on the right-hand side, are true. The propositions on the left-hand side are false. Now, the propositions that are true, that is, this half of the middle circle, is the area of certainty. It is a very neat arrangement, is it not? But though these divisions are used at least from page 58 to 85, and that's why I said I can give you a few pages, but it's scattered all the way through. This isn't just a little paragraph in the book. It's almost 30 pages, you see. Though these divisions are used at least from page 58 to 85, here and there, one must ask, what good are they? The right-hand half of the inside circle, certainty, means no more than that proposition X, which we happen to believe, is true. It helps not at all in determining whether proposition X is in fact true. And as for certitude, the whole of that circle, it is of no use whatever. The author's attempt to distinguish certitude from certainty neither harms his opponents nor helps him. The essential point in apologetics is to defend the truth of X, and this schematism does not do so. Indeed, to anticipate, the book as a whole fails to explain any method by which one may determine the truth of a particular proposition. A few incomplete procedures are mentioned, but the obvious objections to them are ignored. What I have said briefly, and I can briefly resume this page and a half that I've read by saying that using the term certitude and certainty do not advance the argument at all. They give you no notion of how to proceed. Furthermore, they're not very well distinguished, and so on. That was supposed to be an example of his inability to define his terms. Now, that was the second case of poor definition, wasn't it? Now, there is a third definitional flaw. Not so much a definition that is faulty as the absence of a definition that is needed. Embedded in the previous useless material is a phrase that calls to mind Wittgenstein's words in the Tractatus. His words are, "that which is the case." In fact, I think that phrase occurs in the very first sentence of the Tractatus. But I haven't read the Tractatus for, oh dear, 15 or 20 years. But I think that's right in the very first sentence of the Tractatus. Wittgenstein's phrase is "that which is the case." Hannah's phrase is "a state of affairs." Already quoted is, and this is repeating the quotation, "certainty is the intellectual apprehension of an objective state of affairs," end of quote. Obviously, then, we cannot know what certainty is until after we know the phrase, until after we know what the phrase "state of affairs" means. I am certain, that is, I am certitudinous, that the author would agree that states of affairs are fundamental to apologetics. On pages 25 and 26, he characterizes a particular attack on Christianity as formidable on the ground that it is made on the basis of epistemological objectivism, the view that there are extra-subjective states of affairs. And continuing the quote, "other criticisms of the Christian faith which repudiate epistemological objectivism cannot be taken seriously," end of quote. Then on page 32, he says, "the very nature of Christian faith is predicated on epistemological objectivism, the view that there are extra-subjective states of affairs," end of quote. This quotation that I just read and the previous one sort of indicate that he thinks that true propositions are not states of affairs. But what then is a state of affairs? Later on page 77, he continues in the same vein, quote, "the constitutive tenets of any position are referential meanings, for they are propositions. A proposition," this is all quote, "a proposition is an assertion that some state of affairs does or does not obtain. A state of affairs is," this sounds as if it's going to be a definition, "a state of affairs is anything that is or is not, anything that does or does not have a certain property, or anything that is or is not related to something in a particular way." Oh dear, that does take in a lot of ground, doesn't it?
Please turn the tape for the continuation of this lecture.
I guess maybe I better read that part of the quotation over again. "A state of affairs is anything that is or is not, anything that does or does not have a certain property, or anything that is or is not related to something in a particular way. Every proposition," this is still quote, "every proposition," which is essentially the meaning expressible by a declarative sentence, "refers to a state of affairs. That is why constitutive tenets are referential meanings. The truth value, truth or falsity, of a proposition is determined by the state of affairs to which it refers. Well,
can I ask just for you to re-clarify your position? You said that it sounded to you like you didn't mean state of affairs to refer to logical...
Did you notice that this last quotation is self-contradictory? I'll read it again and then go on. And I think I will cover what you ask in the next paragraph. Well, just let me, I'll read it a little faster this time. I don't know whether to read slow and give you time to think. Maybe I read slow and that annoys you and you don't think. If I read fast, well then, by the time I get to the second line, you've forgotten the first. All right, I'll read this quotation again. And if you understand what I'm driving at, you won't have too much trouble getting the general drift, even if you miss a point or two. I am trying to show that he fails to define the essential terms of his own position, and hence he leaves his readers without any idea of what he means. So here is what he says on 77. The constitutive tenets of any position are referential meanings, for they are propositions. A proposition is an assertion that some state of affairs does or does not obtain. A state of affairs is anything that is or is not, anything that does or does not have a certain property, or anything that is or is not related to something in a particular way. Every proposition refers to a state of affairs. That is why constitutive tenets are referential meanings. The truth value of a proposition is determined by the state of affairs to which it refers. End of quote. This I find not merely unsatisfactory, but even self-contradictory. Besides indicating Hannah's dependence on the phrase state of affairs, the sentence, in its context, at least seems to deny that propositions are states of affairs. The proposition is a statement about a state of affairs. And if a proposition does not refer to itself, it is hard to see how Hannah could consider a proposition a state of affairs. There is another word used very frequently, which, like Wittgenstein's unintelligible phrase, "What is the case?" seems to me to be equivalent to the word given or givenness. In German, from Kant on, das gegebenes. Hegel, of course, denied that anything is given. So did St. Augustine. Hannah, toward the end of his book, attempts to show how we can know that something is given. In my opinion, his attempt is a failure. And in addition, if it were not a failure, it would be a failure. For a process that identifies the given and distinguishes it from something else shows that the given is not a given, but an intellectual interpretation. The given, or state of affairs, seems to be synonymous with the term real. The state of affairs is what is real. But such synonymous terms do nothing toward identifying any reality. What is real? What is a particular state of affairs? What is given? Are dreams real? They are real dreams, are they not? Are mathematical equations real? The logical positivists, if they used the word real, would say, no, mathematical equations are not real. Are propositions real? By giving propositions reference, R-E-F-E-R-E-N-T-S, not C-E-T-S, by giving propositions reference, and with other wordings, the author seems to exclude propositions from the real, objective world. In that case, we can never know the state of affairs, but only a replica, symbol, or picture of it. No extra subjective reality could be in one's mind, could it? a picture of a reality is not that reality, is it? If the picture is in our mind, the thing itself is outside and unknown. Unknown because whatever is known must be in one's mind. One further question. Is the sensation of red or the taste of chocolate real? Realism, whether Plato's intellectual realism or the physical realism of the 1930s, insists that man can know reality and not just a mental reproduction of it. Hannah's position, even though he may not recognize or acknowledge it, is that a state of affairs is unknowable. Lest anyone think that the foregoing criticism attacks a straw man and does not present Hannah's views fairly, there is a sort of negative evidence to the contrary. On page 109, we read, quote, "Thoroughgoing presuppositionists categorically deny the possibility of apprehending any state of affairs in a purely objective way." That is, the doctrine of immaculate perception is a delusion. He is trying to explain the positions he's opposing, you see. He is against presuppositionism. And presuppositionism says we can't apprehend states of affairs in a purely objective way. And he calls this the doctrine of immaculate perception and says that's a delusion. Let me say it again. The presuppositionalists are asserting that the doctrine of immaculate perception is a delusion. I can continue with a quote. "For every act of apprehension is an act of interpretation." Now, that is his description of presuppositionism. That's the end of the quotation. If the term objective is taken in Hannah's empiricist sense, this is a very accurate statement about one essential part of presuppositionalism. Clearly, he accepts for himself the Roman Catholic superstition of immaculate sensory perceptions. Neither of us is attacking the straw man. That is, he knows what presuppositionalism is, and he attacks their point of view, and since I quote him verbatim, why, I'm not inventing a straw man. If you can show that my interpretation of him is incorrect, then my arguments don't apply, but at least I quote him. But while his descriptive statements with regard to presuppositionalism are usually quite accurate, though he made that previous blunder about fideism near the beginning of the book, descriptive statements regarding presuppositionalism are usually quite accurate, his arguments seem peculiar at times. For example, to select another case where the harm is minimal. I'm using this not as an important point, but just as an example of how he confuses things. Hannah asserts on his own that, quote, "no position can escape such givenness, not even the most radical skepticism," end of quote, page 102. You want to turn to 102. Let me read this. I am giving this as an example, and I admit it is an example of only minimal importance, but it shows a tendency. It's an example of a tendency. And this example is his assertion, quote, "no position can escape such givenness, not even the most radical skepticism," end of quote, page 102. This mention of skepticism heads in the wrong direction. If Hannah had wished to commend his veridicalism, he should have said, "no position can escape givenness, not even Hegelianism, for it is the latter that is best known for resolutely abolishing das Gegebenes." It is this kind of mistaken direction that weakens the relevance of some of his arguments against his opponents. The crux of the dispute, however, is his success or failure in explaining how a state of affairs can be known, or more broadly, how knowledge is possible. If his theory cannot produce knowledge, then despite his attempts at refutation, presuppositionalism remains at least a possible choice. It is necessary first to state Hannah's theory of justification. This is no easy matter, for it is both confused and incomplete. Any interested reader must consult the text and make his own decision. However, whatever the readers think, it seems to this reviewer that Hannah's first principle is the existence of states of affairs. And before proceeding, the reviewer wishes to point out that this is a presupposition, for Hannah neither shows how this principle can be deduced from something more ultimate, nor how a state of affairs can be identified. Unfortunately, connecting presuppositionalism with Karl Popper and his disciple W.W. Berkeley III, all of which you find on pages 94 and 95 if you're looking at the book.
If I could interrupt just a second. Yeah. I didn't know you had to do that with first principles.
Do what?
What you just said.
You have to say what they are. You have to write your axioms down, and he doesn't. I am assuming that he regards a state of affairs as one of his first principles, but he doesn't say it. In fact, if he said it, he'd be contradicting himself, because he doesn't want to be a presuppositionalist. Do I make myself clear? To the kind of system I want is a system in which you state your axioms and deduce your conclusions. He does not state his axioms, but he says he doesn't have any, and yet he seems to assume, without any proof, that there is such a thing as a state of affairs. At least he doesn't define what a state of affairs is. And what we have seen already, it apparently means that we can't possibly know any state of affairs. We only have a picture of it, and we don't have the real thing. Unfortunately, connecting Christian presuppositionalism with Karl Popper, and you see, here's another case that indicates to me that I have correctly understood what he means by presuppositionalism, because he is now contrasting it with Karl Popper. And if you know what Karl Popper said, well, then that explains this. Unfortunately, connecting Christian presuppositionalism with Karl Popper and his disciple Berkeley, Hannah stated that, and this is on 94-95, the attempt of non-justificationalism to dispense with irrefutable starting points is a failure because, I've omitted a few words and put in the word because. This doesn't alter the sense, as you will see. Let me read it over again. The attempt of non-justificationalism to dispense with irrefutable starting points is a failure because whenever a truth claim is made, the claimant is under a rationality norm to provide justification when it is expected or requested. End of quote. Here, Hannah entangles himself, for he never, so far as I can see, justifies this his fundamental claim. Is not this his presupposition? The situation is not as if the presuppositionalists reply with a simple tu quoque and let it go at that. Aristotle, though far from being a presuppositionalist, in Book Gamma of the Metaphysics, showed how, at least in his view, thought he showed how the principles of logic are embedded in every intelligible sentence. He also argued that unless an argument went back to first principles and stopped there, an infinite regress would be necessary, and therefore the justification could not be completed. If a veridicalist, to use this new term, or anyone else that rejects first principles, wishes to refute the present-day presuppositionalists, he cannot be excused from facing their argument. Hannah does not face it, though, to use his own words, we expect and request it. Points 2 and 3 on pages 95 and 96 insist on givenness. Presumably, the author means sensory givens, for otherwise, a first principle, a proposition, might be a given. And this is what he seemed to deny earlier. He said they weren't givens. He further criticizes his opponents on the ground that they, quote, operate with a principle of adequacy that is logically prior to the apprehension and utilization of biblical statements. Therefore, the formal principles function as a neutral criterion. This is on page 98. This, however, is a serious misunderstanding of the theory Hannah is attacking. As briefly indicated in the previous reference to Aristotle, the laws of logic are themselves embedded in every declarative sentence throughout the Bible. Since, however, they are not stated explicitly, as they would be in a logic textbook, a learner may come to know them only after he has read and thought upon various biblical passages. Most people, in reading any book, are interested in its explicit subject matter and do not consciously repeat to themselves the laws of disjunction, conjunction, and implication. So too with the Bible. But this does not mean that logic is a neutral criterion, a set of non-biblical principles. God is truth, and Christ is the wisdom and logos of God. One may admit that the axioms of logic are of more universal application than many other scriptural axioms. One may also admit that the other axioms could not be true without these all-embracing logical forms. But since the other axioms cannot be deduced from the forms of logic, no axiom can ever be deduced from anything else, they too remain axiomatic. At any rate, logic is biblical, not neutral. And somewhere or other, I try to show that logic is the, to use a sort of a metaphorical term, logic is the architecture of God's mind. Strangely, Hannah almost always avoids the term and the idea of axiom. He uses the word twice on page 96, and perhaps once or twice elsewhere. But usually, throughout his descriptions of presuppositionalism, he obscures the point that his opponent defends a system of truth. You might remember in my first lecture, the first written lecture, I tried to emphasize that apologetics was interested in a system of truth, not disjointed truths that are all confused and unsystematized. We're interested in a system of truth. And Hannah doesn't seem to recognize this. He obscures the point that his opponent defends a system of truth consisting of axioms and theorems. This contrasts with a chaos of independent and unrelated givens. Hannah faces the difficulty of imposing some sort of order on, shall we say, his brute facts. Perhaps, too, had he grasped the idea of systematic truth, he might have found it more difficult to argue against presuppositionalism. This also disposes of point 2 on page 98, where he denies that the laws of logic can be used as postulates or axioms. Now, didn't one of you say that he asserted that the logic was a presupposition or something? Well, now look at page 98, where he denies that. He says, quote, "The principle of non-contradiction cannot be postulated simply because it's a necessary condition of every," and he underlined the word every, "simply because it is a necessary condition of every act of presupposition or postulation. This because seems to have no force. If truth is a logical system, its first axiom must be the law of contradiction, or the law of identity, which is really the same thing. Even non-presuppositionalists and non-Christians try to axiomatize logic."
This concludes Dr. Clark's lecture entitled Veridicalism.